This CLE course is based on the New York State appellate decisions released in June of 2020 that deal with issues related to civil procedure. Selected decisions from June 2020 were summarized. The summaries were posted on the New York Appellate Digest website, and those June 2020 summaries have been compiled into the June 2020 Civil Procedure Update pamphlet, which is available on the podcast page and which serves as the written materials for this CLE course. The page references are to the pages of that June 2020 Civil Procedure Update pamphlet. The first case is on page 7. It's Knapp versus Finger Lakes. It deals with the appealability of an order which is made after the judgment. In this case, an order that relates to a motion to set aside the verdict. And it overruled precedent. Fourth Department, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Troutman, overruling precedent, held that an order issued after judgment, here an order on a motion to set aside the verdict, can be appealed. And the court wrote, "We must consider whether a party may appeal directly from an order denying a CPLR 4404 motion, that's a motion to set aside the verdict, when that order was entered after entry of a final judgment. In some of our previous cases, we have concluded that such an order is subsumed in the judgment and the right to appeal directly therefrom is terminated." And there's a reference to this case, Paul Revere Life Insurance Company versus Campagna, 233 AD 2nd, 954, that's 4th Department, 1996. "We now conclude that the rule set forth in Paul Revere Life Insurance Company is inconsistent with the statutory framework and with Court of Appeals precedent and should no longer be followed. Accordingly, we hold that an order otherwise appealable as of right," and it cites CPLR 5701 subdivision A for orders which are appealable by right, "entered after the entry of a final judgment is not subsumed in the judgment, but is independently appealable. An appeal may be taken as of right from an order that involves some part of the merits, affects a substantial right, or refuses a new trial," again citing CPLR 5701 subdivision A. "If, however, a court enters an intermediate order and subsequently enters a final judgment, the Court of Appeals has held that the entry of the judgment terminates the right to appeal from that order. Although the right of appeal terminates, the order is not beyond review. There's a statutory remedy. An appeal from the final judgment brings up for review any non-final judgment or order which necessarily affects the final judgment, or any order denying a new trial," citing CPLR 5501 subdivision A. "Therefore, CPLR 5501 subdivision A salvages the ability of aggrieved parties to seek review of the intermediate order on appeal. On the other hand, orders entered after the entry of a final judgment cannot conceptually merge into the judgment. The rule in Aho," that's the Aho case 39 New York 2nd 241, "applies only to an intermediate order which the Court of Appeals has defined as an order made after the commencement of the action and before the entry of judgment. Consequently, inasmuch as the right of appeal from a post-judgment order remains in effect, we conclude that the appeal from the order here is properly before us." So to reiterate, the Fourth Department here has ruled, overruling precedent, that there is an appeal from a post-judgment order, that it has not been subsumed into the final judgment. Next is the Chi Young Lee case on page 8. It's another case dealing with appeals. Simply stands for the proposition that there's no appeal from a refusal to sign an order to show cause. The court wrote, "No appeal lies from an order declining to sign an order to show cause, since it is an ex parte order that does not decide a motion made on notice," citing CPLR 5701A2. Next is Matter of State Farm Insurance on pages 8 and 9. It deals with the effect of failing to comply with the provisions surrounding the service of a petition for seeking arbitration. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the insurers at State Farm's notice and petition to stay arbitration was not served within the required 20 days and was not properly served. The petition, therefore, should have been dismissed. The court wrote, CPLR 7503 subdivision C requires that an application to stay arbitration be made within 20 days after service of a demand to arbitrate. This limitation is strictly enforced, and a court has no jurisdiction to entertain an untimely application, citing CPLR 7503C. CPLR 7503C also directs that notice of an application to stay arbitration shall be served in the same manner as a summons or by registered or certified mail return receipt requested. State Farm did not file its notice of position, a petition and petition until beyond the 20-day statute of limitations. Consequently, the proceeding is time-barred. In addition, State Farm's notice of petition and petition to stay arbitration were served by regular first-class mail rather than registered or certified mail return receipt requested, since there was a lack of compliance with CPLR 7503 subdivision C, the present proceeding was jurisdictionally defective. So the failure to serve the notice of petition and the petition seeking to stay arbitration within the 20 days required by CPLR 3503 and the failure to serve the notice of petition and petition in the manner prescribed by CPLR 7503C renders the whole proceeding jurisdictionally defective. Next is Center for Independence of the Disabled versus Metropolitan Transportation Authority, pages 9 and 10. It's a class action. It deals with the failure of the City of New York to accommodate persons who cannot use stairs under the New York City human rights law, and it raises the application of the continuous violation doctrine under the New York City human rights law. First Department, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Gish, determined that the transit authorities and the city's motions to dismiss the complaint in this putative class action were properly denied. The complaint, brought pursuant to the New York City human rights law, alleged discrimination against persons with disabilities which prevent them from using stairs. 360 of the 427 subway stations in New York City are accessible only by stairs. The First Department held, one, the action was not time barred because the continuous violation doctrine applied. Two, the action was not preempted by either transportation law or public authorities law. The controversy is justiciable, and the city, which owns the stations, was not entitled to pre-discovery dismissal. With respect to the continuous violation doctrine, the court wrote, the reach of the continuous violation doctrine under the New York City human rights law is broader than under either federal or state law. A broad interpretation is consistent with a rule that neither penalizes workers who hesitate to bring an action at the first sign of what they suspect could be discriminatory trouble, nor rewards covered entities that discriminate by insulating themselves from challenges to their unlawful conduct that continues into the limitation period. Thus, defendants' claimed failure to provide an accessible subway system is a continuous wrong for purposes of tolling the statute of limitations under the New York City human rights law. Next is the Mid-Island case on page 10. It's another class action case, and it lays out some criteria for determining whether there is an issue that is common to all members of the class. The court wrote, the gravamen of plaintiff's claim, and that for which they seek class certification, is that defendant provided them and others similarly situated with inferior adulterated heating oil. That is, that the fuel oil that was delivered to them contained oils of lesser value mixed into the ordered grade of fuel oil, so that the delivered product did not meet the standards of the party's contracts. Contrary to defendant's contention, this is the predominant question of law and fact in this case, and it is common among the class. In any event, the fact that questions peculiar to each individual may remain after resolution of the common questions is not fatal to the class action. Moreover, CPLR Article 9 affords the trial court considerable flexibility in overseeing a class action, and the court could even decertify the class at any time before a decision on the merits if it becomes apparent that class treatment is inappropriate. Supreme Court is more than able to recognize if its class certification becomes unduly cumbersome, and if so, how best to fashion a remedy. Next is Currid versus Vallea on page 11. It's a disclosure case specifically relating to tax returns. First Department noted that the disclosure of tax returns is disfavored, but agreed with Supreme Court that disclosure of the redacted returns in this labor law / employment law dispute was warranted. The court wrote, plaintiffs claim that between 2010 and 2016, defendant employed them as a caretaker for her ailing aunt, and that defendant violated several sections of the Department of Labor regulations requiring overtime pay, a minimum wage, and additional pay for split shifts. Defendant denies that she was plaintiff's employer for purposes of the regulations and provisions of the labor law, but admits that she paid plaintiffs by check from 2014 to 2016, albeit on her aunt's behalf. Plaintiffs claim that they were paid in cash by defendant between 2010 and 2013. Defendant, who denies that she was the source of the cash payments, seeks plaintiff's federal and state tax returns for 2010 to 2013, claiming she needs the returns to verify the cash amounts, as well as plaintiff's assertion that they were employees and not independent contractors. Defendant demonstrated both that the specific information ordered disclosed was necessary to defend the action and unavailable from other sources. Since plaintiffs were paid in cash between 2010 and 2013, and there's no other evidence in the record establishing who paid their wages and how much they were paid during those years, defendant showed a specific need for the production of the 3 years of tax returns, which might show the amounts claimed by plaintiffs as income from the caretaker work, as well as whether they claim the income as wages or as money earned through self-employment. Defendant demonstrated that investigating plaintiff's bank accounts would be inconclusive, since pay deposited in the accounts could have been commingled with other amounts, and because one of the plaintiffs claimed that she used several banking institutions and did not make deposits on a predictable basis. We note that the court already inspected the tax returns in camera and deemed them relevant. Next is Demirjian on page 12. It's another disclosure case involving tax returns, this time involving a motion to compel and whether there's a waiver of an objection to the demand for production. The First Department noted that the failure to respond to the defendant, his name is Mazel, to defendant Mazel's demands for production waived any objections to the demands. Mazel's motion to compel discovery, therefore, was properly granted. However, objections to demands which are palpably improper are not waived by a failure to respond, and Mazel's demand for tax returns may be in the palpably improper category. Mazel's motion to compel the production of tax returns should therefore have been denied. But the First Department denied that portion of the motion to compel without prejudice and granted leave to renew if Mazel can make the required showing of need. The court wrote, a demand for the production of tax returns is disfavored and requires a strong showing of necessity and the inability to obtain the information from other sources. Here, the failure to identify the particular information the tax returns will contain and its relevance to the claims made should have been sufficient to deny Mazel's motion to compel. However, Mazel argues that the tax returns could be relevant to its affirmative defenses of latches, estoppel, waiver, ratification, and consent, and the motion court did not pass on this issue. As a result, although Mazel did not sufficiently show the inability to obtain the information sought from other sources or, indeed, what specific information the appealing party's tax returns will show, we grant leave to renew upon a proper showing. Next is GMAC Mortgage. On page 13, it deals with a conflict between a stipulation of discontinuance and a change of attorney stipulation, which was filed but which was incomplete. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held a stipulation of discontinuance executed by the plaintiff's then attorney and filed after plaintiff's change of attorney stipulation was filed was valid and enforceable. Plaintiff's change of attorney stipulation was not signed by an agent or representative of the plaintiff. The court wrote, an attorney of record in an action may only withdraw or be changed or discharged in the manner prescribed by statute. Pursuant to CPLR 321 subdivision B, an attorney of record may be changed either by filing with the clerk a consent to change signed by the retiring attorney and signed and acknowledged by the party, with notice of the change given to the attorneys for all parties in the action, or by order of court upon notice to all parties. Until an attorney of record withdraws or is changed or discharged in the manner prescribed by CPLR 321, his or her authority as attorney of record for his or her client continues as to adverse parties unabated. Here, the stipulation of discontinuance was executed by an attorney with the plaintiff's then attorney of record, hereinafter called outgoing counsel. Though the plaintiff's stipulation to change its attorney was filed prior to the date on which the stipulation of discontinuance was filed and was signed by outgoing counsel and incoming counsel, no agent or representative of the plaintiff signed the change of attorney stipulation. Nor does the record establish that notification of the plaintiff's change in attorney was provided to any other party or to the appellant prior to the date on which the stipulation of discontinuance was filed. Accordingly, the plaintiff neither filed a properly signed consent to change attorney nor sought a court order permitting outgoing counsel to withdraw as the plaintiff's attorney of record in accordance with CPLR 321 subdivision B prior to the filing of the stipulation of discontinuance. And therefore, the stipulation of discontinuance was valid and enforceable. Next is DELAP, D-E-L-A-P, on page 14. It's another case dealing with a stipulation of discontinuance, this time involving the effect of the discontinuance upon the jurisdiction of the court. The Third Department, reversing Supreme Court, held once the stipulation of discontinuance was filed, Supreme Court lacked any supervisory control over the proceedings. So the subsequent motions dealing with the allocation of settlement proceeds to the plaintiffs and their attorney should have been denied. After the stipulation of discontinuance, a plenary action was required to enforce or set aside the settlement. The court wrote, when an action is discontinued, it is as if it had never been, and Supreme Court lacked authority to grant any of the requested relief. Next is the Golden case on pages 15 and 16. It was an attempt to bring a public nuisance action against the church based on sexual abuse by priests. It was dismissed for failure to state a cause of action, but it does have some useful information about when the violation of a statute gives rise to a private right of action. In this case, it was Penal Law 240.45, which is criminal nuisance, and the court held that it did not give rise to this private right of action. Fourth Department held the complaint seeking damages and injunctive relief against the Diocese of Buffalo, New York, stemming from alleged sexual abuse by a priest, did not state a cause of action for public nuisance based on common law and penal law, section 240.45, which is criminal nuisance. The court noted that a nuisance suit in this context would conflict or compete with the classification system under the Sex Offender Registration Act, and to the extent plaintiff seeks damages, a suit pursuant to the Child Victims Act is available. Now, with respect to whether a private right of action arose from Penal Law Section 240.45, that's criminal nuisance, the court wrote, Penal Law Section 240.45 does not imply a private right of action under the circumstances presented here. Where a penal statute does not expressly confer a private right of action on individuals pursuing civil relief, recovery under such a statute may be had only if a private right of action may fairly be implied. Three essential factors are considered in determining whether a private right of action may fairly be implied. 1. Whether the plaintiff is one of the class for whose particular benefit the statute was enacted. 2. Whether recognition of a private right of action would promote the legislative purpose. And 3. Whether the creation of such a right would be consistent with the legislative scheme. And again, those criteria were not met here. Next is matter of COIA, which is on page 17. It's a forum non conveniens case arising in a custody matter. The Fourth Department noted the record was sufficient to allow the appellate court to determine whether New York was an inconvenient forum in this custody case. Mother had moved to California with the child after father abused mother in New York. Father filed the custody petitions in New York. After considering the statutory factors, the Fourth Department found New York to be an inconvenient forum. With respect to one of the factors, that being the location of relevant evidence, the court wrote, "The location of relevant evidence, and to some extent the ability of the court in each state to decide matters expeditiously, also favor California as the appropriate forum. The majority of the evidence pertaining to the best interests analysis in this custody matter is located in California. Although evidence relating to certain domestic violence incidents is more readily available in New York, most other relevant information regarding the child's best interests, such as her school performance, response to therapy, the indigenous tribe she belongs to, and her relationship with her extended family, is in California. It does not appear that the child has any connection with New York other than the father and a paternal grandmother. Further, the attorney for the child in New York was having trouble providing effective representation to the child inasmuch as it was difficult to communicate with the child by telephone." Next is Modugno, or Modugno, M-O-D-U-G-N-O, which is on pages 18 and 19. It's just mentioned here because it deals with a judge's sua sponte order dealing with an issue not raised by the parties. The Second Department held the Labor Law 200 and Common Law Negligence causes of action properly survive summary judgment, but the Second Department noted the court should not have sua sponte denied appellant's motion on the ground that deposition transcripts were inadmissible because that issue was not raised. So again, this just simply mentions the fact that a judge does not have the power to sua sponte raise and decide an issue that was not raised by the parties. Next is the Trenton case on page 19. It's another case dealing with an action taken by a judge sua sponte. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the judge should not have sua sponte granted relief that was not asked for by the plaintiff. Plaintiff sought cancellation and discharge of a mortgage pursuant to Real Property Actions and Proceedings Law, Section 1501. The judge canceled the mortgage and the note. The court wrote, "The court may grant relief that is warranted pursuant to a general prayer for relief contained in a notice of motion if the relief granted is not too dramatically unlike the relief sought. The proof offered supports it, and there's no prejudice to any party. Here, the plaintiff only sought cancellation and discharge of the subject mortgage, not cancellation of the note. The Supreme Court should not have granted additional relief sua sponte." Next is matter of Dush versus Erie County Medical Center on pages 21 and 22. And it's included here because of its reference to when material submitted for the first time in reply papers can be considered by a court. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court over a two-justice dissent, held claimant's application for leave to file a late notice of claim in this medical malpractice action should have been granted. The court noted that the medical records submitted for the first time in a reply were properly considered because the respondents addressed the relevant issues at oral argument. On that issue, the court wrote, In general, the function of reply papers is to address arguments made in opposition to the position taken by the movant, and not to permit the movant to introduce new arguments in support of, or new grounds or evidence for the motion or application. This rule, however, is not inflexible, and a court, in the exercise of its discretion, may consider a claim or evidence offered for the first time in reply, where the offering party's adversaries responded to the newly presented claim or evidence. Next is Windnagel, pages 22 and 23. It deals with the failure to comply with a discovery scheduling order and the appropriate sanctions. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the dismissal of the complaint was too severe a sanction for plaintiff's failure to comply with the court's scheduling order. The court wrote, defendants merely allege that plaintiff's failure to comply with the discovery deadline set forth in the scheduling order was due to the representations of plaintiff's attorney that he was engaged in settlement negotiations with a claims adjuster. Plaintiff's attorney apparently believed that the settlement of the case was imminent and thus that the depositions would not be necessary. There is also nothing in the record to indicate that plaintiff ignored any warnings from the court that continued noncompliance with discovery orders could lead to the court striking the complaint, or that defendants were prejudiced by the delay in conducting discovery. Although plaintiff's dilatory conduct may have reasonably prompted defendants to seek the court's guidance, the drastic sanction of dismissing the complaint with prejudice provided more relief than was necessary to protect defendants' interests. In short, plaintiff's conduct was not the type of deliberately evasive, misleading, and uncooperative course of conduct or a determined strategy of delay that would justify the penalty of dismissal of the complaint. Next is Matter of Arthur M. on pages 23 and 24. It deals with standing in a zoning or land use case. The Third Department, reversing Supreme Court, noted that the abutting neighbors, Katie and Collie, had standing to contest the town planning board's approval of the construction of a dollar store. The court wrote, Katie and Collie's residence is directly adjacent to the proposed construction site, and the proposed retail store would be directly across the woods from their property. The store's main parking lot, which is located behind the store, is in the line of sight of Katie and Collie's property. As a result, the store is likely to obstruct or interfere with the scenic views within the scenic viewshed overlay district from Katie and Collie's property. Katie and Collie have standing because they've demonstrated that they would suffer an injury in fact, that is actual harm by the action challenge that differs from that suffered by the public at large, and that such injury falls within the zone of interests or concerns sought to be promoted or protected by the statutory provision under which the agency has acted. Next is Schoenholtz and Drossman on page 24. It deals with the issue of stare decisis. Third Department, reversing Supreme Court, dealt with the issue of stare decisis in this dispute between defendant employer and plaintiff employee over the demutualization proceeds of an insurance policy. Plaintiff was employed as a certified nurse midwife by defendant. As part of the employment agreement, defendant was required to maintain and pay the premiums for a malpractice insurance policy. When the insurance company converted from a mutual insurance company to a stock insurance company, which is called demutualization, the policyholder was entitled to nearly $50,000. Plaintiff employee claimed the money was hers and brought an action for a declaratory judgment. Supreme Court agreed with plaintiff, but because there was no on-point appellate decision by the Court of Appeals or the Third Department, Supreme Court was required to follow a First Department decision and, based on that decision, found in favor of defendant employer. The Third Department noted that it, unlike Supreme Court, was not bound by stare decisis and reversed. The court wrote, Supreme Court was bound by the doctrine of stare decisis to apply precedent established in another department, as no relevant precedent was available from this court or the Court of Appeals. However, this court is not so bound. We agree with Supreme Court's inclinations, although that court was constrained by stare decisis not to follow them, and we disagree with the First Department's holding. Next is Washira Dusit on pages 26 and 27. It's a statute of limitations case involving a postnuptial agreement. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the statute of limitations with respect to the enforcement of a postnuptial agreement is that provided for in Domestic Relations Law Section 250, not the six-year statute of limitations for contract actions generally. The court wrote, "The six-year statute of limitations that pertains to breach of contract causes of action, that CPLR 213 subdivision 2, is not applicable. The applicable statute of limitations is provided for in Domestic Relations Law Section 250. Pursuant to Domestic Relations Law Section 250, the statute of limitations for claims arising from prenuptial and postnuptial agreements is 3 years, and that period is tolled until process has been served in a matrimonial action. The language of the statute makes it broadly applicable to claims arising from prenuptial and postnuptial agreements, such that it applies equally where a party seeks to invalidate the agreement and where a party seeks to enforce it." Next is Creative Restaurant on pages 27 and 28. It's another statute of limitations case. It deals with the continuous representation doctrine, which tolls a statute of limitations in the context of architectural malpractice. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the complaint alleging architectural malpractice should not have been dismissed pursuant to CPLR 3211. Plaintiff leased the first floor of a building to operate a pizza restaurant. Plaintiff hired a contractor, which in turn hired an architect for the heating, ventilation, and air conditioning design. The gas hookup was completed in 2014. Subsequently, in 2016, National Grid shut off the gas, alleging plaintiff was stealing gas. In 2017, the defendant architect allegedly attempted to remedy the problem with the gas line. The complaint adequately pled the statute of limitations was tolled by the continuous representation doctrine and a privity-like relationship between the plaintiff and the architect. The court wrote, "The plaintiff's submissions, which included evidence of continuing communications between plaintiff and the architect, and evidence of the architect's efforts to remedy the alleged error uncovered by National Grid regarding the gas line connection for the premises, raised a question of fact as to the application of the continuous representation doctrine. Contrary to the architect's contention, the fact that 2 years had elapsed between the completion of its services and its subsequent efforts to remedy the problem does not render the continuous representation doctrine inapplicable as a matter of law." Next is U.S. Bank on page 28, another statute of limitations case, this time in the context of foreclosure. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the mortgage debt was never accelerated, and therefore the six-year statute of limitations did not begin to run in this foreclosure action. The court wrote, "The May 3, 2007 notice of default, which advised that the loan would be accelerated if the default was not cured by June 7, 2007, was nothing more than a letter discussing acceleration as a possible future event, which did not constitute an exercise of the mortgage's optional acceleration clause." So because the debt was not accelerated, the statute did not begin to run. Next is the Santana case on page 30, another statute of limitations case, this time involving a continuing obligation on the part of landlords. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff could seek rent overcharges based upon a 1986 rent reduction order. The court wrote, "Since rent reduction orders impose a continuing obligation on landlords, tenants are entitled to recover for any rent overcharges occurring during the applicable limitations period by reference to rent reduction orders that remain in effect during that period, even if the rent reduction order was initially issued outside the limitations period." As it was here, it was issued back in 1986. Next is the Hall case on page 31. It deals with how to handle... It deals with a sua sponte order by a judge, which is not appealable, and how to handle such an order. First Department reversing Supreme Court in this shareholders' derivative action against a low-income housing development fund corporation held, 1. Although a sua sponte order is not appealable, the appeal of the dismissal of the cause of action for an accounting is heard here in the interest of justice, and 2. The proper way to handle a sua sponte order is to move to vacate it and then appeal. So in this case, the court is hearing the appeal in the interest of justice, but ordinarily the way to handle a sua sponte order is to move to vacate it and then appeal the denial of that motion. At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation for this June 2020 Civil Procedure Update CLE course. The verification code is VACATE. Again, the verification code for this June 2020 Civil Procedure Update CLE course is VACATE. The final case is Humble Monkey on page 32. It's another case dealing with the propriety of a motion to vacate versus the propriety of an appeal. The court wrote, when defendants failed to comply with the self-executing conditional order striking their answer, if they did not produce a witness for deposition by a date certain, the order became absolute, citing CPLR 3126 subdivision 3. Defendant's proper recourse was to move to vacate the conditional order on the ground of excusable default, citing CPLR 5015 subdivision A. They did not seek that relief. In any event, the excuses for failing to comply with the court's order that defendants asserted in opposition to plaintiff's motion were not reasonable, and defendants failed to seek an adjournment from the court or take any other action to avoid their knowing default. So again, in this case, the failure to comply with a self-executing order to produce a witness for a deposition can only be attacked by a motion to vacate, not by an appeal. So that concludes this June 2020 Civil Procedure Update CLE course.